All right. Welcome to the Cava Ships podcast. We try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cava Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. Experience shipbuilding innovation with HII at Modern Day Marine, April 30th to May 2nd at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. HII is dedicated to empowering the U.S. Marine Corps U.S. Navy team with cutting-edge technologies. Learn about HII's latest innovations with ship design and construction for the future of amphibious warships. Discover more at hii.com/MDM24. HII, delivering the advantage.
Coming up, there have been numerous events, hearings, and meetings discussing naval issues over the last few weeks. Vago Maradian joins us to highlight key takeaways from recent naval headlines, and we'll have some parting thoughts from the latest Sea Air Space Symposium. But first, a look at naval news this week.
All assets to build and operate a U.S.-sponsored pier in Gaza are in place, U.S. officials said it April 25th. While at least two of the ships that left the U.S. with gear for the pier suffered delays en route, the officials said there was enough redundancy in the shipments that the delays, quote, had absolutely no impact. Everything is on track, officials said, for the pier to begin operations in May.
France's carrier Charles de Gaulle left the naval base at Toulon April 22nd for an operational deployment named Aquila. The carrier and her strike group will initially operate in the Eastern Mediterranean and, for the first time, will be under Strike Force NATO command.
The aircraft carrier USS George Washington bid farewell to Norfolk, Virginia, April 25th, as she began a transit around Latin America that eventually will see GW transfer home port to Yokosuka, Japan. For the transit around Latin America, known as Operation Southern Seas, George Washington will be accompanied by the destroyer Porter and oiler USNS John Lenthal and embark units of Carrier Air Wing 7. USS Ronald Reagan, who relieved GW as the U.S. Navy's forward-deployed carrier Japan in 2015, is expected to leave Yokosuka shortly to head to San Diego, where the two carriers will formally hand over, after which GW will continue to Japan and Ronald Reagan will begin a maintenance period on the U.S. West Coast.
A newly cleared shipping channel in Baltimore, Maryland, opened for full-sized merchant ships April 25th, with the bulker Balsa 94, the first of four large vessels that day to pass through a newly cleared channel through the debris of the fallen Francis Scott Key Bridge. Clearing operations are continuing under the direction of the U.S. Navy's supervisor of salvage.
In new ship news, the U.S. Coast Guard commissioned the new national security cutter Calhoun, WMSL 759, on April 20th at her home port of Charleston, South Carolina. Calhoun is the 10th and penultimate NSC, with the last in the class, Freedman, under construction at HII's Ingalls Shipbuilding.
The Virginia-class submarine New Jersey, SSN 796, was delivered to the U.S. Navy April 25th, the U.S. Navy announced. New Jersey is the 23rd Virginia-class sub and the 11th delivered from HII's Newport News Shipbuilding. The submarine is to be commissioned on September 14th. And in San Diego, a keel ceremony was held April 25th at GD NASCO for the new expeditionary sea-based ship Hector A. Cafferata Jr., ESB-8. The ship is the sixth ESB, all built at GD NASCO. The most recent ship, Robert E. Simonac, is to be christened on May 4th.
And in old ship news, U.S. Coast Guard Patrol Cutter Orcas, WPB 1327, was decommissioned at Coos Bay, Oregon, April 22nd, after a 35-year career. She was built in just a year in 1988-89, and at the time was expected to serve between 12 and 15 years. Of 49 cutters in the original class, only seven remain in commission, and most of those who have been decommissioned continue to serve under friendly foreign flags. And that's a look at just some of this week's naval news.
All right, moving to the discussion portion of the podcast, we are delighted to be joined by Vago Maradian, the editor-in-chief of the Defense and Aerospace Report, the capo, tutti capo, the capo of all capos, our patron. Vago, thank you very much for joining us.
Chris, thanks very much. Chris, thanks very much. I really appreciate that. It's a nice massage. I really appreciate that. And I just wanted to say that you guys do an absolutely terrific job. I know that this is kind of a self-licking ice cream cone,
right.
But it's just an honor and pleasure to work with both of you guys. It was terrific seeing you at Navy League. I know we're going to talk about that a little bit, and it's great to be on the show. Thanks very much.
Well, you mentioned Navy League, Vago, and that's really the reason that we decided to do this segment this week. Between the 3 days that we collectively spent at Navy League, between the, I guess we're up to four or five different, and maybe even more, testimonies on Capitol Hill by Navy leaders, the secretary, the CNO, some of the deputy CNOs, as well as different events that we've all either dialed into or attended in person. There are a number of issues that have been raised over the last couple of weeks that we haven't had a chance to specifically spend some time on or bounce off of the guests that we've had. And so we thought this would be a great opportunity to talk about some of those. Vago, let's start with Navy League. I'll ask you and Chris the same question, and then I'll chime in. But what caught your attention over those 3 days? I mean, both you and Chris tend to spend a lot of time talking to both uniform leaders, civilian leaders, and leaders in industry. What sort of things did you pick up? What's in your notebook when it comes to Navy League?
I know Chris is probably going to talk about this, right? It was a lost messaging opportunity. And I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about it as a group. We had some breaking news to try to tend to, but Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners joined us. And he also looked at it as a lost messaging opportunity. The Navy is in some ways not moving as quickly as I think everybody would like to see the Navy move. On the other hand, in some places is doing a terrific job. You know, Chris and I were at a Huntington Ingalls event, an HII event with Chris Kastner, the CEO. And there was a lot of discussion about how the Navy is actually moving the wheel forward in terms of investment. Increase capacity coming out of eventually coming out of the shipyards, building up that supplier base. AUKUS is a success story at every level if we can get it. And honestly, if the gap between getting the submarines into the hands of the Australians might take longer than we would like it, certainly the forward deployment of four boats to Australia or five boats gives us a force multiplier effect, right? I mean, as they say, one boat in San Diego is worth 1.4, in Guam is 1.7 in Australia. So the Navy had a lot of these really great news stories. It didn't get them out. I thought, you know, it was a mistake by the CNO. I think everybody, by the SECNAV, hitting industry with both barrels by the time before Navy League. When we got to Navy League, it was a more attenuated message, a little bit more talk about partnership because, you know, I mean, the Navy can't act like, oh, my God, you know, my ships are late. The schedules are all off as if it's a disinterested bystander. The Navy is the central player in its own drama and, you know, it has to be realistic. You know, a smaller Navy deployed more often. Ships are going to be out longer. When they're out longer, they miss their availabilities, wash, rinse, repeat, derailment. So, I picked up a better messaging, little attenuated on the message. But there's a lot of stuff the Navy really has to think through more carefully, whether it's on naval aviation with the FAXX sidelining, whether it's what that future force looks like, and actually how to thoughtfully accelerate ships. I mean, we've talked about the frigate on this program many, 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 many times. You know, that ship was off-the-shelf design in order to get it into the hands of sailors sooner. It's at least 3 years late. And, you know, I think Rick Hunt and the team at Fincantieri are consummate gentlemen, Mark Vandroff. But, at the end of the day, very little of that ship is common anymore to what the original design was, right? I mean, so the Navy controls all of this. And I would love to see the Navy kind of do a better job in sort of wrapping its arms around it, because if the Navy doesn't change, I think the joint force and the nation is going to be worse off for it.
Chris, either riff off of what Vago said or introduce some other items that you've been hearing, following. You spend a lot of time, we talked about this before, but you spend a lot of time on the floor. In fact, all your time on the floor, talking to industry, talking to Navy leaders versus sitting in panels. What did you pick up at Navy League or during testimony or some of these other following events that you know are either making your head hurt or that you're following?
Well, it took about, it almost took 4 seconds of walking in the door, the main entrance to the floor, before somebody started shouting out to me, "Cavus, what's going on here? Come on, start talking." And the general sense I got from a lot of people was just frustration. Frustration from industry. At the top of that list is the whatever the campaign is about shipbuilding, it comes off as a campaign against shipbuilders. And Vago just talked about it. The Navy's portion, the Navy's hand in this, is almost never discussed by the Navy. It's all been blaming industry for a great deal of things since February. And also, the Navy's not really explaining this in very serious detail. The secretary doesn't want to do gaggles anymore with the press. He's not doing essentially press conferences. The CNO is sort of sloganing without a whole lot of content. When she does something, does engage with the media, which is very, very, very selective and rare, other people are just not very forthcoming. And it kind of makes you wonder what's going on. They keep announcing some new effort and some new this, some new study, or there's some study was completed, or but then they don't release the study and let's move on to something else. And so what? The so what factor is they sort of walk by it. And Vago just touched on it. The frigate was supposed to be 85% common with the Italian Fremm. That's how they sold that program. And that was the criteria to be a competitor. And at the moment, from the best we can all figure out, it's no more than 15% common, which is a big problem for Fincantieri since they bid on a ship that they're no longer building. I'm pretty happy. I myself am not in that situation. I don't know what Fincantieri Marinette Marine is going to do about it. But it's fine if the Navy comes clean and says, we decided we wanted to redesign the ship to put in all of our standard features, to put in all these things that are not included in foreign designs, to include survivability features and capability features. That's all well and good, but it all adds up. It adds up big time. And now you have this program that is, at the moment, not looking good on any level, both in the shipyard and frankly, in Washington at Naval Sea Systems Command. What's going on? I don't know. But everybody's got a hand in this. And a lot of us have seen this happen before, multiple times. And here we go again. There's no real partnership. Anyway, people are just really frustrated. And when people are frustrated and they feel like they're shut out, they want to talk. They're cranky. And I'm not kidding. It 4 7 seconds of walking on the floor, people started shouting out, and it continued. People were cranky. That's not a dig at the Navy. That's an actual fact. So, there is this huge frustration that's out there. Leadership, I suppose, was, I mean, the briefings I heard, as is not unusual. There was a lot of nothing, but every now and then there is something if you can sit through it all. The briefings from Naval Air Systems Command and Naval Sea Systems Command, which are very, very extremely popular and hotly anticipated, were once again pretty thin. And while there was some content there, not nearly on the level that there'd been in years past and that people would hope for. For one thing, there hasn't been a briefing on the destroyer program in years, the Arleigh Burke program. We've got 70 some odd ships in service. What's going on across those ships? That's the most important service platform in the U.S. Navy. I don't know. We haven't heard from the program manager. in years, literally. We haven't had a DDGX, the new destroyer program briefing, in years. So what this means, though, is that the public discussion is based on whatever the last official information was put out. And all that information is out of date. And the Navy can say, well, you know, everything's changed. A lot's changed. Okay, well, what's changed? I don't know. I mean, if you're just going to keep it all to yourselves, we don't know what's going on. Is it going well? Is it going badly? Are you managing it? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Is this a dip? Is it a temporary? What's causing this? Is this a supply chain issue? Is it an operational tempo issue? Who knows? But when you don't do these briefings, and there's really only one or two times per year that these briefings happen. People are not working with good information. By the way, the same thing used to happen on the Hill in Hill testimony, that, you know, in years past, you know, this is one of those, you know, halcyon days of yesteryear. Some of us have been around too long. And I remember when congressional testimony used to be quite detailed about these things. And a lot of information could be gleaned from the annual posture statements. That's no longer the case. It's mostly sloganeering and happy stuff. And, you know, we're on top of this and we're doing that. Awful lot of slogans. And that's the most frustrating element that's out there. That said, you know, industry is who's happy to talk, you know, as always, is hotly trying to figure out what the customer wants, in this case, the Navy or the Marines. What do they want, and what can we do to give them what they want? So industry is very, very simple to read. They want to make money. That's all they want to do. They exist. They are companies who need to make profit for their shareholders. It's extremely simple. And if they don't do that, they either lose their job or they go to jail if you don't try to do that. And, you know, they're trying to sell stuff to the military, to the Pentagon. Their frustration factor is trying to get a direction from the Navy and from the Pentagon. Tell us what you want. Give us a clue. And they do. I mean, there are absolutely places where that does happen. It's not that it doesn't happen at all, but it happens, you know, in closed doors and secret. I think too much. We all know that there are technical details that you don't want to divulge, and that's legitimate and that's fine. But even announcing efforts is becoming just a real challenge. Can you talk in any depth besides the name of your effort? We're doing this. Okay. Can you tell us more about it? Well, I think that's all we got right now. And it's just, it goes around and around and around.
I want to go back to you real quick before I jump in. You had an ad.
Yeah, I mean, the only ad I would add, I mean, just I didn't mean to sort of jump the gun, but I just wanted to get this brief point in. And I think, I mean, as much as it's difficult to say this, it was a sense that the Navy is adrift. I mean, that was one of the things that sort of came across. It's got a willing industry. Everybody's ready and primed. I think people see the self-evident case for sea power and the role of naval forces in the Indo-Pacific as deterrent, as well as a key warfighting tool. But this sense that whether it's on cultural, sort of command culture, a whole bunch of other questions that people still have, and I know you guys discuss regularly, messaging from leadership, that sense of urgency that we need in the Indo-Pacific. I mean, some are certainly exhibiting it, right? Admiral Aquilino was a paragon of that urgency. I think Admiral Paparo, everybody knows, right? I mean, Admiral Aquilino was in Japan this week, you know, driving home that case. And we see sort of a more accelerated sense of urgency in the rhetoric. We've certainly been hearing it from the Marine Corps and the reforms that General Berger launched and that General Smith is pushing, maybe in attenuated fashion, but he's still pushing that. The Army is leaning forward in the spurs. And then the Air Force, I would argue, is leaning farthest forward in drive fast, get capability out. That we've got to really step up our game if we're going to deter the Chinese, and God forbid if we have to fight them. And against that, you don't get that sense of urgency. You get it from submariners. I think that was the unfortunate sense that people had. We're not being engaged. We're not being talked to. We're being beaten up on. I think it's a missed opportunity and an opportunity for, as you guys have been urging for a long time, for the Navy leadership to be a little reflective and be like, hey, we're writing our own destiny here, right? What do we have to do? It's more than just, I got a lot of money for ships this year, which seems to be the measure of merit, unfortunately.
Chris and I were talking yesterday, actually leading up into this discussion we're having now. And a major part of the frustration is that, where is the urgency? Where's the outrage about things that are not going well? I'm serious. Where is the outrage? Why aren't people firing people and throwing things? What's going on with the big deck amphibious ships right now is an absolute travesty. And I don't understand it. I still don't understand how you could have one of the major ships burn for 4.5 days in a major port and you threw it away. And nobody seemed to be that upset about it. They just didn't. And then at the same port, the same command, the same ship, we have USS Boxer, which has become an open sore and was delayed in its latest deployment. It was supposed to deploy in, late January. They didn't go out until early April. They finally deployed after both other ships in their ARG had left. Another one was late, by the way, too. And then 10 days later, they come back to San Diego with apparently a malfunctioning rudder. I mean, what is wrong with this? And of course, we talked about the command investigation a few weeks ago. That just revealed an immense amount of apathy on the command of that ship. And that reflects also on every other command that oversees that ship and is supposed to be part of it. And what is going on here? And then there's that. There's the Navy's inability to, carpe diem, seize the day. Sea power, the need and importance for sea power is on full display right now, certainly in the Red Sea. This has been a major factor, the importance of presence, the importance of combat capability, the importance of just being there. You got to have ships to be there. This is, your point is being made. The importance of investment in sea lift. They're trying to do this pier in Gaza. A number of ships left the U.S. East Coast. Two of them had problems getting over there. One had a fire, had to turn around and go back. One broke down, and I think the Azores. The investment is just not there, but the Navy's not putting this message out there. They're not saying, see, this is what we're talking about. And these moments are just passing them by. Other people like us, get cranky and talk about this. But the Navy itself doesn't say, see, this is why we need more investment. This is why we need some way to fund this. And it may not be in the traditional funding methods that fund the standard fleet every year. But there are other ways to fund this and that have been done in the past, certainly the Sea Lift Fund. And where's the sense of urgency? On the one hand, the Davidson window is closing every day. On the other hand, we act like we have years, years and years and years before anything is happening. All right, that's my rant. I'm going to go off. Cervello.
let me put my PAO hat on. I guess what I would say is I think there is some opportunity in this crisis. And I think you guys did a really objective job of identifying some of the sore spots and some of the issues that the Navy is working through. Not mentioned in the sort of the list that you guys provided is the recruiting challenge that the Navy is facing worse than the other services. The Navy for the second year in a row will miss its recruiting numbers by about 6,700. It could get worse. Although, Vice Admiral Cheeseman, the Chief of Naval Personnel, said they were able to do better than they thought they were going to do. So that's progress. And so anytime you miss the recruiting numbers, I mean, that has 3-4-5 year issues. You almost don't see the problems for 3 or 4 years, and then you have to work through that. But out of the testimony and out of events that CNO Lisa Franchetti has done, she's talked about this need to do a conversation with America. This to me is the glass half full. I think that it may not be the cultural issues. It may not be some of the readiness issues, but it may be recruiting that kind of forces the Navy to be more deliberate in how it delivers its messaging to the country, how it talks about itself, both with its inside and outside voice, and how it embraces things that it, you know, previously had not embraced, whether that's data and learning principles, whether it's, you know, straight stick messaging, whether it's doing a better job of engaging the media or engaging the Hill. So I guess I'm hopeful that they at least recognize that this recruiting issue is not just about the number of recruiters that they have, or not just solely about the employment opportunities that exist in the country right now, that they need to do a better job of explaining what the Navy does, how it affects the American people, and the opportunities that exist for young men and women to be a part of that effort. I think if they can wrap their arms around that, it will have tertiary benefits to some of the things that we're starting, that we've identified here and have some real concerns with. Over.
Navy, it's not just a job, it's an adventure.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what the MCPON talked about during his testimony and other events. That's what grabbed him. I mean, I would say as somebody that spent 2 decades in the Navy, whether it was an adventure or, you know, pick your favorite word, but you're right. I mean, that sentiment, you know, they need to do a better job of selling what the Navy does. That's taking advantage of the current events. That's telling a few sea stories, but it's getting out there and hitting the pavement sort of figuratively and literally to make sure that people understand that. Now, this has been a problem for a while, right? I mean, you guys have heard this concern probably several times in your career, right? We saw Vice Admiral Morgan in the early 2000s shepherd this event on behalf of, you know, previous CNOs. We've heard, you know, from our friend Denny Moynihan, who was the chief of information at that time, and he tried to do this. We've done everything from basketball games to increased Blue Angel visits to fleet weeks around the country. But hopefully Admiral Franchetti, you know, puts her own personal stamp on this. And, you know, if it doesn't work, you keep trying over and over again. Baga, you're taping this as we talk. You're taping, having just come from an event with the Submarine League. You mentioned AUKUS in your list of things that you were tracking. Hum us a few bars on things that have grabbed your attention about AUKUS.
I'll keep it brief. I mean, first, anybody who knows me, you know, sort of sees me as a little bit of a closet 1120 anyway. Love the submarine force. And I think folks recognize that it is a discriminator in warfare, right? I mean, the unfortunate thing is that the submarine force has not yet bottomed out because of some of the very unfortunate decisions that were made almost 2 decades ago. So there's going to be some more years that's going to play out. And so the focus is, how do you get more available submarines, more availability out of the force you have, right? Nuclear reactors is doing a heroic part. I think the submarine force is doing a heroic job trying to, you know, increase availabilities, get ships forward. And again, that's where AUKUS, I think, is particularly important. You got to try to get more bang for your bucks, and you're going to have to do this with your allies and partners. I think that there's a sense, you know, it's not moving fast enough. That's something that I think the three of us have and many others have talked about. But you also have to look at how fast the wheel is really turning. We already have the first class of prospective commanding officers and folks who are going through nuclear school. If you had said that 5 years ago, that this is where we would be at this point, folks would probably not even believed you. We're making progress on getting those boats forward, and they're going to be operating forward. And I think that the notion that the Australians might not be up for the task is, you know, because I think people have a mental model of the Collinses as problematic boats. They were, you know, the maintenance culture wasn't there. They made a couple of bad calls. a lot of those problems have been resolved. The boats are available. Cabas, you know better than I do, but I think there might be actually two of them underway now. There's at least one of them underway at any given point, which is very positive. And there might be actually two underway now. And so it's a country that's making what is a generational commitment. It's an extremely expensive commitment. The boats themselves are only about 30% of the investment. But I would really give a lot of credit that this wheel is moving. The Japanese are now part of Pillar Two. So to try to get the benefits of that, I would figure out a role seriously for the French in this somewhere, if it's possible. I mean, I granted the French were upset about how this all played out, but it is, you know, the European Pacific power. And so the more we engage with the French and the more we do, U.S. Philippine exercises this year includes a French frigate, which I think is a breakthrough. So the sense is, you know, it's important for folks to sort of tune in and find out where AUKUS really is right now. What's the myth? What's the reality? There are going to be future boats that Australia and the UK are going to be developing, but there's, of course, a lot of discussion on, okay, well, how do we harmonize within those, right? So those designs might be, might have some things in common, might have a lot in common, but then what are some of the things we can do to make sure that actually three navies share certain components, to try to reduce operating costs? So, you know, I mean, I went from somebody who was like, but I mean, I would say at Navy League and afterwards, it was a really healthy sort of update, reset your needles on how to think about AUKUS, if that wasn't too long of an answer, Chris.
No, that was good. I mean, I think that that provides context. Cavis, I want to ask you, we're getting towards the, I guess, the back third of this discussion, this BOGSAT, bunch of guys sitting around talking about naval issues. You spent some time down in Norfolk on the waterfront. So you, went from Navy League, and you and a few other trade reporter colleagues went down to Norfolk. You spent some time. Any takeaways from that? Anything you want to share from that opportunity?
Every year after Sierra Space, I kind of shepherd a small group of reporters down in Norfolk. The idea being we don't always get to go down and just take our time and look at things. Most people go down and they're very focused about a particular story. So this is a chance to do things more generically. It's a little bit different every year. We sat down with Commander Naval Air Forces Atlantic for lunch. He was very good about his concerns. It was an off the record lunch, but that was very good. Visited several units, mine hunting group, some aviation platforms. Actually, the C-2A Greyhound COD carry on board delivery, the last squadron that's operating them, was really interesting, and the challenges they have been going through, VRC-40 in the last 5 months or so, 4 or 5 months, with the grounding of the Osprey. And of course, in the Pacific, the Osprey had already replaced the C-2A, which is a very old aircraft, in the carry on board delivery role. And suddenly, just as you were being phased out, they had to step up and jump in. That really was an untold story in that whole Osprey grounding thing, which went on for months. It was very interesting to hear a lot of their stories about how they stepped up, how they, they had five detachments out at the same time, which was the most they'd ever had. These are normally two plane detachments that go out with aircraft carriers. It was just, and there used to be another squadron on each coast. The West Coast Squadron was disestablished in the fall. So they really had that was a good story. That was a really good story of, you know, people stepping up in the background. And it's not a glamour aircraft for a lot of people. It's not a strike fighter. It doesn't, blast away with the sound of freedom, but it's a really essential part of a deployed aircraft carrier's operations. And they really stepped up. That was really nice to see them. It was also nice to go to visit VRM-40, which is the new Osprey COD squadron that is just being established. And of course, they were grounded for a while. They were actually trying to transfer three aircraft from California to Norfolk when the grounding occurred a few months ago, and they were stuck in Fort Worth, Texas. That just happened to be where they were. They were doing a refueling stop. So they had just flown in like 3 days before the first aircraft from Fort Worth. It was interesting to talk to them. I've seen these aircraft. That's the first time I'd seen one of the COD B-22s up close and personal. It's interesting. It's not quite the same aircraft. It's got added fuel on board and of course communications to operate with the aircraft carrier. But it was fun to talk to them. We also visited a couple old ships. Part of the message about operating a Navy is that not everything is the latest and greatest. As a matter of fact, you never want everything to be the latest and greatest because it's all going to become old and moldy at the same time, and you can't replace everything. So all services are filled with systems and weapons and platforms that some of them are brand new and it's cutting edge, and some of them have been around for 10, 15 years and are in midlife, and some of them are, 25, 30 years old, but they still need them to operate and be effective on some level. And they're all important. You can't just take out something because it's old and say, that's it, we're done with it. No, we still need you to work. So we visited USS Carter Hall, which is a landing ship dock, which had just returned from an extended deployment with the Bataan Amphibious Ready Group and the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit. They were operating in the Persian Gulf and then in the Red Sea for months. The Carter Hall they were sort of beaming with pride when they came home because they had a nice big silhouette on the side of their ship of a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle. So they're apparently the first amphibious ship to have shot down a UAV. They shot down a Houthi UAV using their RAM missile system, self-defense system. That was different. They've been out for 8 months and they came home and you know what? They looked pretty good. I got to say that ship did not feel beat up and used up. And it was impressive. We also went aboard submarine USS Pasadena, who is scheduled to be inactivated in the next fiscal year. They looked pretty good too. They were full of torpedoes. They looked like they were ready to go. It'd been a while since I'd been on a Los Angeles class sub. It's good to go on the previous subs because the Virginia class is a wonderful design and has any number of improvements and advantages, but you got to know where this came from. And the previous class was, these are big capable submarines, but they're unbelievably tight. And it's just, it's amazing. It never ceases to amaze me what designers can cram into a submarine. Every little space is used up. And I'd been on 688s before, but most of the group had not, and they were really amazed. It's like, wow, how do you sleep here? How do you move here? It was good stuff. So I mean, it was kind of like the variety of things. Just a bit of flavor of people who don't always make the headlines, who don't always get a lot of attention. And by the way, everything is not always screwed up. The headlines are either, usually something is screwed up. That certainly makes headlines. But, an awful lot of most of the Navy are people doing their job, keeping their systems going, dealing with the issues and the problems that they have. And everybody has issues and problems. These were all, relatively short visits. We certainly weren't spending hours and hours with each one of these units, but it does add up. And it added up to, in this case, we're seeing amphibs, we're seeing submarines, we're seeing aviation. And it does make you feel better about things. Just a little snapshot, but good stuff.
So we're getting to the end. Bago, I'm going to ask you to kind of take the last topic, and this will seem like an odd topic maybe for this podcast, but Earlier in the week, the Air Force picked Anduril and General Atomics to continue developing their autonomous collaborative combat aircraft concepts. And those designs were picked over Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman. Vago, why should a Navy audience follow the Air Force's collaborative combat aircraft milestones? And why should we care that Anduril and General Atomics were picked?
Thanks very much, Chris. And it's a great question. I'm going to say just two things. 637s forever. Chris, right, visiting a 688 puts in sharp relief the size of a Virginia. For those of us who remember the Sturgeon class 637s, they were a good 60 feet smaller than even if you were on a long hull, you were about 60 feet shorter than a 688. So anyway, talked about a cramped, even if it had certain better design features. Anyway, and one quick point about the COD. I think it's a mistake to sunset the COD. I think it's a terrific idea to get the V-22, to get that vertical lift, to be able to take stuff directly from shore to smaller decks without necessarily having to hit the big deck. But the bottom line is we don't have enough lift support for the carrier force in the best of times. And where we're going, we are not going to have that kind of capacity and be able, I think, to do it the way we're doing it. So I understand we're doing it. We're saving money. We're transitioning. We're not remanufacturing the C2s, but I think that it is something that at some point folks ought to be thinking about. It's not about fleet-wide groundings, but it's about getting capability to the fleet. So that's my concern, and I've kind of been there for a long time about that as an admirer of the COD force. About your question, why should the Navy care? Look, the United States Air Force has a bit in its teeth and has had a bit in its teeth about the next generation air dominance aircraft. Everybody knows that the down select is going to happen later this year, and Secretary Kendall wants first unit equipped, I think, by 2028. That is a very aggressive schedule for a couple, for about 100, 150 very cutting edge aircraft that are going to be that front edge. And then these collaborative combat aircraft, there's going to be about 1,000 of them that are going to be the autonomous systems that are controlled, by NGADS and other systems, to be able to take the fight to the Chinese, whether it's the air-to-air battle or whether it's the air-to-ground battle. It matters because the Air Force, Chris, using your term, right, has been doing sets and reps. The program was conceived when Secretary Kendall was Undersecretary for Acquisition. It's been moving forward in the black world. There's a lot of CONOPS work that's happened. And so the right way to do FAXX and the Navy's collaborative combat aircraft is actually to draw on the U.S. Air Force's investment in these capabilities. It is going to be much easier for the Navy to follow on the enormous amount of work that they've been doing, including, by the way, on unmanned systems, small, medium, large. I know the Navy's been doing work on this as well, but I mean, there is a certain discipline and cadence to the way the Air Force, and indeed has been using some black, highly classified capabilities as well. So I think it matters because the way the Air Force has done this is to pick two companies that have a lot of skin in the game. Everybody knows General Atomics has the aircraft that is actually flying. It has an X designation. It's the OBSS aircraft. So either way, the Air Force knows there is a company that has an aircraft that has a very modular frame. It has a common core. You change the wings and the sensors, but it can perform a multiplicity of different missions. And then they also rewarded the innovative upstart company that's made the case, hey, but coach, as you would say, Chris, send me in. And they don't feel like they got that tap. And if in fact said, hey, you're not innovative until you pick us. Well, the Air Force said, put your money where your mouth is. We're tapping you, go in the game, show us what you got. What's different is they're also messaging to the big contractors, hey, you guys think there is no competition. We found one company that's been around more than a Silicon Valley company, as well as a Silicon Valley company, and they're going to bring a different approach to this. So I think it's a real message, and I think it's a terrific opportunity. Let the Air Force blaze some of these trails. I remember Secretary Roach and Secretary England, when they were Air Force and Navy secretaries, figured out, hey, the future generation of aircraft, the Air Force one will operate off runways, the unmanned aircraft, the Navy one will operate at sea. But gosh, there's a lot of systems commonality that can exist between these two aircraft if we just harmonize them. And I think whether on NGAD and CCA, there's a terrific opportunity for the Navy to augment its naval air power, but do that in a more economical, more focused way by piggybacking off of the investment the Air Force is making, has been making, and indeed is going to blaze that trail a little bit ahead. So it's easier to be a fast follower in this case than necessarily the first mover on this. So I actually think it's a possible boon for naval aviation. Over.
Well, Vaga, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to stop it there. We've covered a lot of ground. We need to have you back on more frequently. I love it because the tables are turned. For years, you guys used to ask me hard questions. And now for 45 minutes, I get to ask two experienced reporters hard questions. So thank you again for joining us.
Honor and pleasure. Thanks very much, guys. Keep up the great work. Really appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vaga Mouradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support. The Cavas Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. Experience shipbuilding innovation with HII at Modern Day Marine, April 30th to May 2nd at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. HII is dedicated to empowering the U.S. Marine Corps, U.S. Navy team with cutting-edge technologies. Learn more about HII's innovations with ship design and construction for the future of amphibious warships. Discover more at hii.com/MDM24. HII, delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavas Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavas. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.